of the morning of October the 6th. President Noyes and Hellman present. Now, Mr. President, we were talking about Jefferson yesterday.
Right.
We want to go back to him. And just a frivolous but an intriguing point here. I notice one writer says, when Thomas Jefferson walked across the street from his boarding house to the Capitol in Washington, did he live in a boarding house at the time? Do you know?
I don't know whether he did or not, but he didn't walk across the street to the Capitol. He rode to the Capitol on horseback and tied his horse to the hitch rack and walked into the place where he was inaugurated. He did not walk at all. He rode a horse.
They describe Jefferson as a long, gangling...
He was a very tall man, I think 6 feet two or something like that. And they painted him as awkward in public appearance. You know, he never made any public speeches. He did all his by writing. And his messages are classics in the way they're put together. And they're all worth reading, every single one of them. But the statement that Jefferson walked across from his boarding house is not true. All the rest of the history books are true. He rode a horse up there, horseback. He was expecting to ride with Adams. And Adams left town at midnight, so Jefferson just rode his horse on up to the inauguration point of inauguration, I guess. The new capital at that time was far enough along, so the inauguration took place in the capital.
Oh, yes, you're talking about inauguration. This writer may be referring to other days, not the inauguration.
He may have.
Well, he lived in the White House then.
He lived in the White House after he was inaugurated.
So he did not have. But just as a point of color and a footnote, do you have any special source of information on how he happened to be on a horse, if the history books are incorrect? Would you have any special source of information?
Well, he rode up from Monticello. Rode horseback up from Monticello, and I have an idea that he stayed in Alexandria, one of those towns close to Washington, just rode on into the capital to be inaugurated. I think that would be a sensible thing to consider. But he didn't come up in his famous cart that he invented to ride in back and forth from Washington to his home. He rode horseback all the way from his home down in Virginia to a place, I think, any place that is convenient to stay all night, and then just rode into the capital.
Did you know whether he had a guard with him, or did he ride alone?
No, he didn't have any guards. They didn't have any guards on any of the presidents in those days. And they didn't begin to put guards on them until McKinley was shot.
But up to that time, presidents were completely unguarded.
Unguarded entirely.
Well, that's an interesting point.
Except by the place where they happened to go, the crowds were great. But the presidents had no special guards until they got assassination of McKinley, and then Congress passed a law assigning the Secret Service two jobs, one to catch counterfeiters and one to protect the president. And there's been no president harmed since that law was passed. Although they did shoot at Roosevelt down in Miami and killed the mayor of Chicago in the same car with him.
They did take a pot shot at Theodore Roosevelt, didn't they?
Well, that is after he's out of office. That is in Milwaukee.
Milwaukee.
They shot him after he made a speech. Some nut shot him and he had something in his pocket that he turned the bullet, and all it did was scrape some hide off his ribs.
Now, you said something about Jefferson not making any personal addresses or speeches, and that he used the medium of messages, that he wrote out his messages. And in that sense, he also was the first president not to appear before Congress in person when he delivered the message on the State of the Union. He wrote it out.
He wrote it out. And from then on until Woodrow Wilson, no president ever himself delivered his message to Congress in person.
You say that he was not a good orator. How was he in appearance? His pictures show him in a very aristocratic face, but... was he nervous at all?
I don't think he was in any way nervous, because he had had association with all the heads of states in Europe that amounted to anything at that time. And he was always the leader of a conversational debate wherever he happened to be. And if you notice the Declaration of Independence, where the suggestions were made by Franklin and the other member of the committee on the Declaration, the basis of the whole thing is in Jefferson's own words. Changes that he accepted were minor and made the thing much more clear. I've seen, I've got somewhere around here a photostatic copy of the scratched up declaration.
Now, Jefferson didn't campaign when he ran for the presidency. He didn't campaign in any kind of a speech-making operation.
He campaigned through the committees of correspondence. His campaign was entirely by letter from one end of the country to the other, and he had correspondence in every colony of the leading men in that colony. And that's how he organized the party which bears his name. Republican Democratic.
He didn't travel up and down the country, did he?
Not a great deal. I don't think he did a great deal of traveling up and down the country, although he was in Boston and New York and Philadelphia all the time while the Continental Congress was in session. And whether he did any traveling south of Virginia or not, I don't know. I've never run across it.
Well, in a sense, that is a unique campaign in American history, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It established what you might call a precedent in that line. They were the only one that I know of.
The only one that did it that way. And when he was governor of Virginia, did he campaign at all?
Well, he knew everybody in Virginia because he was a graduate of William Mary College, and he knew everybody of any consequence in Virginia. And I don't think it was necessary for him to campaign. In Virginia in those days, the succession was carried on by a clique, just like it is now under Harry Byrd.
Well, in a sense, it's a good deal like certain members of Parliament in Britain today. They're so well known, and they have a setup. They don't have to bother campaigning.
That's right. That's right. Churchill never. I don't think Churchill ever goes into his district. They just elect him anyway.
Well, they also they can run in any district that he chooses to.
That's right.
Yes, as all members of Parliament may.
Well, any congressman can run in any district in any state where he lives. Very few people know that. The congressman doesn't have to live in his district, but it's always better for him if he does.
Well, please explain that, Mr. President. I didn't realize that he can run in any district.
The congressman can run anywhere in the state that he chooses if he thinks he can be elected. He doesn't have to be a resident of the district. He has to be a resident of the state. And that's the federal law, if you really care.
He only needs to designate the district from which he
is. But it's always been customary for the congressman to live in the district. And one outside the district would have a very hard time being elected, I'm sure. But he has that right if he wants to.
That's interesting. I didn't realize that.
Helen Gahanga Douglas ran in a colored district but lived in a white district and got elected. But then some people said it was a special dispensation, but she did
it. No, it was not. That is under the law that governs the election. You see, the laws that govern the election of congressmen and senators and all federal offices, the president and the vice president, are made by the Congress. They're not made by the states at all. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason that the congressman cannot be appointed to fill a vacancy when he dies. They have to have a special election, and it has to be called for the purpose of electing that congressman for the purpose. Now, the senators represent the states, and the governor is the senior officer in the state, and he has the right to have appointive power if a senator dies to fill the vacancy.
Interesting. I knew that. Mr. President, do you happen to recall any special relationship that existed between Jefferson and Washington and how they met and how they got together? What brought them together?
They were neighbors in Virginia. I suppose they'd known each other indefinitely, practically all their lives, no doubt, because Washington was always the prominent citizen of Virginia long before the Revolutionary War started. He was a colonel in the French and Indian War, and saved what was left of Braddock's troops when they were went into the woods up there in Pennsylvania and were shot up, and Braddock was killed. And so everybody in Virginia was acquainted with Washington from the beginning of things in that period, and Jefferson naturally knew him just like any other prominent citizen. Well, I imagine they associated and visited back and forth all the time while Jefferson lived in Virginia. Jefferson was acquainted with everybody in Virginia of any consequence, and almost every other part of the United States.
He was such a complete opposite of Washington in attitude. I wondered whether you would have any special comment to make about how Washington found him useful in it and how he was attracted.
Well, through the Continental Congress is where Washington was a member of the Continental Congress in the time of inception. And Jefferson was in the first meetings of the Continental Congress, and then they sent him over to France on foreign affairs after Franklin came back. And they naturally, he knew every member of the Continental Congress and every colony in the that it was in existence at that time. And I'm very sure that he and Washington were very close friends and close neighbors. And were neighborly in their associations in Virginia.
Yet he allowed him to resign, didn't he, in a contest with Hamilton?
Well, I think that the resignation was brought about by Jefferson himself. I don't think that Jefferson was a man who would play second fiddle to anybody. He wanted to be the leader, and he usually was wherever he appeared. But in his letters that he speaks about Washington, he speaks very highly of Washington as an able administrator, and you'd think they were the closest of friends, but that didn't mean they had to agree on every little thing that took place. And, of course, the difficulty between Hamilton and Jefferson was not a personal one. It was a policy one. Hamilton and Jefferson were friendly, and Washington's cabinet meetings, evidently, were very harmonious. But the time came when Jefferson made up his mind that he would be working under false pretenses if he didn't get out and express his own opinion on how the government ought to be run.
Well, didn't it involve relations with France?
No, that was way early in the Washington's administration when this difficulty came up. It was in the financial policy of Alexander Hamilton where Jefferson fell out.
Some of the Federalists regarded Jefferson as a dangerous doctrinaire, and as a result of that, it took, as I understand, about 30 ballots to get him elected as president.
Yes, on account of the tie vote with Burr, it brought that about. But the same things they said about Jefferson, they said about Franklin Roosevelt and Jackson and every other leader that's got any information to put out in the public.
Yes, it says that it took more than 30 ballots before a few less bigoted Federalists decided that Jefferson could be trusted not to rip up the national fabric.
Well, they called him a Jacobin, you know, which is the same as calling a man a communist today, on account of the fact that he was liberal-minded and was in favor of the French Revolution in its beginning.
Well,
of course,
President,
he didn't like Napoleon.
I would want to ask you is this. It seems then that men with very positive and determined opinions do run up against opposition by small groups, which may make a difference in the history of events.
Well, that's true, but you know, when a man has a program which he believes is for the best interests of all concerned, it doesn't make any difference how many groups may oppose him or put blocks in his way. He usually, if he's right, comes out on top, just as Jefferson did. And he's cited now as one of the best and the greatest of our governing presence in the operation of the government of the United States.
And he surprised everyone in his first inaugural address when it was a very mild and rather conservative statement.
It was a good statement. It's one of the best statements on the State of the Union, which the President has to do when he goes in. His inaugural address is nothing but a statement to the Congress on his program and what he hopes to do. And Jefferson's statement in that inaugural address is for the welfare and benefit of the country, and it's worth reading. And it's not long. It's short.
The point Bill raises about the tie vote and the 36 ballots, a good deal of that was due to the fact, wasn't it, Mr. President? 30 ballots? Well, there was a tie vote with Burr because at that time the Constitution had not yet contemplated a two-party system, and it was each vote was entitled to two. They were voting for two men. President.
Well, no, the objective was this, that the man who received the largest vote in the Electoral College was the president, and the man who received the second largest vote was the vice president. And they didn't vote for two, they voted for each one of them. And in this case,
each man was entitled to two ballots, but each voter had two ballots, didn't he?
I don't think he did. You have to look that up.
Hey. I'll look that up.
This is tape two of the morning of October the 6th. You wanted to go on, Mr. President, to explain the voting for in the early days of the process.
Well, as I read the Constitution and what little history I've read on the subject, under the original arrangement in the Constitution of the United States, they voted for president and vice president at the same time. And the man who got the largest number of votes was the president, and the second was the vice president. Now, Aaron Burr was a conniver, and he managed to get he was supposed to be running for vice president. Jefferson was the man that's considered for president because he had been vice president. It was customary then to for the vice president to succeed the president in the next election. And Burr maneuvered things so that he had a tie vote with Jefferson. Of course, that threw the election into the House of Representatives, and they voted by states. Each state had one vote, and it took a great many ballots before they arrived at a point of view where they were willing to take Jefferson for president and Burr for vice president. And that was on the vote of the states as a unit.
Now, the each state had two votes, was that it?
They had one. Each state had one vote.
One vote.
Which they would cast for president, and then they could elect the vice president, incidentally, after the president was elected. If the president got a majority of the votes of the states, he was the president. And then they'd go ahead and elect a vice president.
Just to sum up the administration of Jefferson, what does he represent in your mind as an advocate of any particular ideology in terms of the United States?
Well, he was an advocate of a strong Republican form of government. That is, a government of a republic, which has no reference to a political party. And he was also well-versed in the history of government from the beginning, as nearly all the members of the Constitutional Convention were. And he knew what he thought was best for the welfare of the people of the country. And you must remember that this was a revolutionary approach, because all the governments up to that time, except the Dutch Republic, had been monarchies, with the idea that the king was the representative of Almighty God. They had the divine right of kings. Well, in this period, from 1760 until 1800, the revolutionary approach was that the government was not by divine right of kings, it was by the consent of the people. And Jefferson was the main advocate of that approach, and the Declaration of Independence proves it conclusively.
In that sense, Jefferson was the first president who spelled out the basic intent of the Constitution and the kind of a government foresaw for the United States.
That's right, although Washington and Adams were both loyal to the Republic. But they had a viewpoint that there ought to be a ruling class, that is, the rich and the educated should be the head of the government. Jefferson's idea was that if the people properly educated, they'd know how to run the government just as well as the top-notch people who at that day were the aristocrats of the time.
In that sense, it was the only practical application of that viewpoint in the world at that time.
That's true. And it's gone around the world. The world's been in a revolution ever since, as a result of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States.
In other words, Jefferson is one of the great world figures as well as a great figure
yes,
of the
there's
United
there's no doubt about that. There's absolutely no doubt about that. No. And so is Washington. Washington is too. Washington is one of the greatest of the great, because he was able to set up a brand new government under a brand new system and make it work.
Jefferson, of course.
Jefferson carried on the thing on a basis that was a little more, much more liberal than the Washington approach to the thing.
But he was the philosopher, really.
That's right. He was the philosopher of the age.
But he sat in the early councils of Washington, so that in a sense the conception of that kind of society and government had some participation in it from Jefferson with Washington.
That's true. Washington, Jefferson, Hamilton, and Knox, and they were the people and the attorney general from Virginia, I think his name, Randolph, were the people who really made the government work. Randolph was attorney general.
Why was Jefferson considered anti-war and anti-navy and that sort of thing?
Well, I don't know why he was considered that, because he was for the establishment of an army and a navy strong enough to keep the government in force and keep it running. And if I'm not mistaken, I think it was along about that time that the Barbary Pirates
exactly.
were put out of business.
That's right, Mr. President. He took action against the Barbary
right.
Pirates. He didn't want to pay any more taxes to these
He was a firm believer in the freedom of the seas. And he was determined that the Barbary Pirates would not hijack the American merchant marine in its transaction of business with the rest of the world. And that same thing had to be carried out through the War of 1812. That is one of the causes of the War of 1812, was the fact that the British claimed that they controlled the seas and that they had a right to search and seize every American ships, and that's what brought on the war.
Well, may I ask whether you recall whether he used his knowledge of history much as you do to make parallels which enables him to see clearly on what he ought to do?
I don't think so, any doubt about that, and I think all the great presidents have done that. I think they have to.
He also invoked an embargo on all shipping to both the French and the British, didn't Jefferson do?
Yes, he did that, and the embargo was also one of the causes of the War of 1812, I think.
Now, just to go back a little bit to the conditioning of Washington by Jefferson, do you know of any basis for taking the position that Washington carried out a good many of the things that Jefferson may have conceived in terms of government?
No, I don't. I don't know of any specific things of that kind, but there are letters of Jefferson in existence commenting on Washington's ability and the way he thought, and that always, in a friendly manner, considered him one of the great administrators of the day because he was able to preside over the Constitutional Convention and get a document out of it, which I think only had it not been for Washington and Hamilton and for the Benjamin Franklin, I don't think we'd have ever gotten a Constitution.
Was the conception Washington's? Did he have a creative mind, or did he carry out the creative thinking of other people?
Well, I can't answer that. He always had credit for being on the right side in all these questions when they came before the Constitution Convention.
Well, that was an exercise of judgment, but do you happen to know whether there was anything in the record to prove that Washington was not in condition in his thinking by the brilliant man that around him, like Jefferson?
Well, I think they were all helpful. Any man who's in a responsible position like that and has able and brilliant men around him is bound to be influenced by ideas presented in the meetings that they hold together, and I'm sure that same thing worked at the first meeting of the Cabinet of the United States under Washington.
Would you go on with that thought, Mr. President? That's important. It's this interrelation between men of different minds, and yet each takes from the other and grows as a result of that.
Yes, sir. No, there's no man in the world, I don't care how brilliant he is, that has a corner on all the ideas, particularly in government, that are for the welfare of the people. And if he is interested in making his responsibility work, if he happens to be president of the United States, he usually has himself surrounded with men who understand the approach of the situation as it is at that time. The situation's changed in every administration, and I think that the beginning of the country was the hardest time that the country ever went through to be sure that the government they had set up was going to work, because it was an entirely new idea.
In other words, while a president makes decisions, he must be open to receive ideas as well as information.
There's no question about that, and the president has to have an open mind. He has to get all the information he possibly can, and information is always difficult to obtain, and the truthful facts behind a condition is before him. And in that, for that reason, he's willing to listen to all the ideas of the people in whom he has confidence.
Therefore, the early presidents, such as Washington, Adams, and Jefferson, were of that mind. They listened.
That's no question about that. There's no question. And they were very well versed in debate, because all of them had been members of the Continental Congress, and that was a debating society, not much else.
Of course, the difference between a president having an open mind and a mind of his own is what makes the great president.
They go together. They go together. A man's got to have an open mind, and then he's got to make up his mind what is right after he hears all the all the information that's obtainable. And when he makes up his mind on the policy and the decision, he must stick to it and carry it through. And that's what Jefferson did when he bought Louisiana.
So that this thing that you're talking about, Mr. President, is characteristically American, isn't it? Previous history shown.
Well, I wouldn't say that it was confined entirely to America. The great prime ministers of Britain and the great rulers of France were surrounded by men of brilliant minds. You take King Henry IV of France, I think the greatest of the French kings, had one of the greatest and most brilliant cabinets that any king any king of France ever had. And he had the greatest administration up to that time that any government of France had. The same thing was true with those great prime ministers of Britain, Burke and a great many others that we can name, and Disraeli. They all had advice and help from the people with whom they surrounded themselves.
One more point with respect to attitude. A lot of stuff is going around these days about imperialism. Was anything suggested in Washington's attitude or Jefferson's attitude other than building up the country and making it into an integrated nation? Was there any ambition for expanding the United States or the beyond their natural limits?
Yes, they all, in that day, all the people of prominence at that time were very anxious to obtain the land between the western boundaries of the colonies, and the colonies all claimed land all the way to the Pacific Ocean, if you remember. And the idea of Washington and Jefferson and Adams and all the rest of the people of that day was to obtain the western boundary of the United States and have it established in such a way that the British and the French couldn't come in behind the colonies and push them into the ocean. And that was accomplished in those early administrations.
Well, they were doing it defensively then. There was nothing aggressive or expansionist in their thinking to spread their wings beyond their normal confines.
There was some attitude that pushed them along a bit, because the settlers in the colonies who were not rich men were going into the western part of the country between the Appalachians and the Mississippi River and settling those territories, the Northwest Territories, they call them. And that resulted in the building up of half a dozen states in that community. And of course, Washington and Jefferson and all the rest of the great men of that time were in favor of establishing the western boundary of the United States on a state basis, and that was substantially the Mississippi River.
Our adventure into Canada was purely defensive at that time.
I think they wanted to annex Canada. They thought Canada would rebel the same as they did. I think that is an expansionist program.
Well, could you develop that a little bit? We wanted to go north then a little bit.
I'm not so familiar with that situation as I ought to be, but in the War of 1812, I think there were two invasions of Canada, both of which failed.
The Great Lakes.
But the battle on the Great Lakes was a successful one. Obtained control of the waters on the north boundary of the United States, but their attempt to go into Canada and make it a part of the United States was a failure.
First time there, yes.
That's right.
Canadians
didn't want to do it.
Did we have any ambition to go to Central America or South America? Did we want to have any ambitions that way?
Not until Polk's administration, when the Texas situation developed. And Texas wanted to become a member of the Union of the United States and was made a member, made a state in the Union. And then the Mexicans and the government of the United States had a falling out, and the country was extended to the Pacific Ocean.
This is the end of the second take, morning of October 6th.
Horse.